assembled a superb team of scientists to review the evidence and to design a prototypical framework for combination prevention. And it's their work, published in the report I hope all of you have this week, that is what you're going to hear about now. Before we start, let me introduce my co-chair properly. You all know Helene Gayle, president of CARE, formerly, although she didn't want me to say this, but you all know it, of CDC and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Helene.
Nothing to do with what I think about my former organizations, just I didn't want to take up a lot of time. Anyway, and I won't take up a lot of time because I think we have an incredible group of people assembled here, and I know you want to hear from them. I would just like to add my words of congratulations and to the work that Richard and Pam have put together in this special Lancet series. I think it does highlight the issues, the challenges, but also the successes that we've had with prevention. And I, along with Richard, hope that this is the kind of work that will help us to galvanize the kind of response that we need to really reinvigorate and invigorate our prevention efforts globally. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it back over to Richard to start the introductions of the panelists.
We're going to go one by one, and then we're going to have, I hope, some discussion at the end. They've all been told to speak for no more than 10 minutes so we can get some debate at the end of the session. We're going to start with Jeff O'Malley. Jeff is currently director of the HIV/AIDS group at UNDP. Jeff's going to talk about the history and challenge of HIV prevention. Jeff.
Good afternoon, everybody. As Richard just said, I'm talking about the history and challenge of HIV prevention based on the first article in the special issue written by Mike Merson, David Sirwada, Noy Apusuk, who's with us today, and me. Of course, everybody in the room, each of us who's been involved in HIV prevention over the last 10, 20 years, we all have our own version of the history of HIV prevention. Even amongst us four co-authors, we each started our work in HIV in different ways, and we each learned our lessons in different ways. David Sirwada was a young physician in Kampala in 1985 when he started to notice chaos amongst young people rather than the older people it normally affected. And then he came across more and more cases of intractable diarrhea. And all of those patients seemed to come from the same place in southern Uganda, a district called Rakai. He sent a blood sample to England to be tested for HTLV-4, which, of course, is what HIV was known as at the time. And it came back positive, and it was the first proof that the same virus that was infecting gay men in San Francisco and L.A. was infecting African heterosexual women in Uganda. He and colleagues set up a cohort of 17,000 people in Rakai 2 years later. And as you all know, the rest is history, especially with that cohort. Around the same time David was in Kampala, Noy was in Bangkok, working with sex workers in the Pat Pong area. She wasn't working on health, let alone HIV. She was working on sex worker organization, on the rights of sex workers to education, to workers' rights, to empowerment. And only a year after Empower was established, in 1986, Thailand found its first case of HIV. A man who'd been infected, a Thai man who'd been infected by a gay tourist. Quickly, Empower moved into this new challenge. It created the first HIV prevention materials for sex workers in the country, perhaps the first in Asia. It combined its sex worker organizing work with HIV prevention, and once again, the rest is history. Like David and Noy, I got involved around the same time, in the mid-'80s. My partner and I both went for HIV tests when VCT first became available. We'd assumed that I'd probably be positive, and we assumed since he'd only had three partners in his life that he'd be negative. The results came back the other way around, and we discovered things like discordant couples and positive prevention before those terms were even invented. It wasn't long, of course, before I took those personal challenges into my professional life. And our lead author, Mike Merson, came a little later, but still long ago to HIV prevention. Many of you know that Jonathan Mann led WHO's global program on AIDS. And in the spring of 1990, in a dispute with the Director General of WHO, Jonathan resigned. Mike, who'd was an established public health professional, had already directed two of WHO's disease control programs, was asked to step in, and he led GPA until the transition to UNAIDS 5 years later. So like all of you, we all have our own skills and training, our own values and politics, our own understandings about sexuality, our own creativity, but also our own blind spots that we brought into our work in HIV prevention. And looking back, certainly David, Mike, Noy, and I all know we made mistakes. Fortunately, we all got some things right as well, and we certainly learned a lot along the way. So the history and analysis that I have to briefly share now, but is outlined in more detail in the article, is necessarily partial and biased. Our perspectives are still skewed by our values, by our training, by our ongoing engagements. Nevertheless, despite how different Mike, David, Noy, and I all are from each other, we all agree on the key messages in the article, and I think that's very powerful. First, politics matter as much as programs. We've learned that successful national HIV prevention efforts are possible, but they're consistently associated with both government leadership and community involvement and activism. And we need the same combination to renew, improve, and sustain our efforts in the future. Second, whatever mix of abstinence, condom use, partner reduction, STI treatment, male circumcision, work in different contexts, these outcomes are always most effectively achieved through combination prevention, a mix of behavioral, structural, and biomedical approaches, derived from evidence, yes, but informed by the creativity, wisdom, and ownership of communities and people affected. And third, successful prevention approaches have always linked HIV to other issues that matter in people's lives, whether that's strengthening local healthcare services overall, enhancing the status of women, empowering marginalized populations to participate in politics. Our article reduces 25 years of history, and I'm going to reduce it even more right now. We describe three main phases of the response to AIDS. The early years, a decade or so starting in the early 80s. The 1990s, where HIV science made great strides, but politics, programs, and responses lost far too much ground. And then the massive mobilization and scaling up of response that began with a series of events around the turn of the millennium. To speak of HIV in the 80s is to speak of fear, ignorance, denial, and intense stigma. But it was also an era of tremendous courage and creativity. The earliest responses to AIDS were largely driven by and invented by people with AIDS themselves, their loved ones, and their caregivers. In 1982, gay men and drag queens invented safe sex, and they still haven't been given the Nobel Prize. Only a year later, in 1983, the PWA movement was born on the fringes of a conference in Denver, Colorado, demanding PWA involvement, leadership, respect in both care and prevention. And it wasn't long before PWAs and their friends were creating new responses and new strategies and new community groups around the world, in Brazil, in Uganda, in Senegal, in the Philippines, in France, and of course in the United States and elsewhere. Nurses, doctors, scientists, public health officials weren't irrelevant to all of this. It was the epidemiologists from CDC who documented the spread of AIDS in the USA and pointed to sexual transmission. It was nurses and doctors in southern Zambia and Chikinkada who invented home care. It was a virologist in France who identified HIV. But through all these years, all of these people working so passionately lacked high-level political leadership from health ministries, from WHO, and from heads of government. It wasn't until 1987 that WHO established the Global Program on AIDS, the same year that ACT UP was created to demand action from the U.S. government. Communities were tremendously energetic and creative, but even the inventions of safe sex, the PWA movement, AIDS activism, home care, and the buddy system weren't enough to slow the spread of the epidemic. Health workers and scientists did their things, but with little funding or political support. It's no accident that the few countries which actually demonstrated political leadership in those years, the Thailand, Senegal, and Uganda in the developing world, places like the UK and Australia in the rich world, those were the places that saw early success. Those became our success stories. The mid to late 1990s, it's a different story. It was the HIV prevention movement's great lost opportunity. While there were some scientific disappointments, as Richard says, around vaccines and microbicides, there's no question that science did its job well in that decade. Most dramatic, of course, is combination antiretroviral therapy. But we also, of course, learned about PMTCT. We gathered evidence of the links between male circumcision and HIV transmission, the role of STI control in certain epidemic contexts. But what about the programs? What about the response? The donor policy and program environment didn't keep pace with the science. WHO's GPA was shut down, and UNAIDS was established for a number of reasons. But whatever the rationale of creating UNAIDS, UNAIDS was created at a challenging time. Hollywood's red ribbon moment was over. UNAIDS inherited a shrunken and largely demoralized staff team from WHO GPA, a much more ambitious mandate, a complex governance structure, and much less money to manage it all. The effects at country level in the developing world were immediate and disastrous. GPA had provided just under $30 million to national programs in 94 and 95, but UNAIDS was unable to continue the support because of how small its budget was. Large numbers of WHO staff who provided on-site technical support in developing countries lost their posts, so advice and advocacy disappeared along with the money. Overall, of course, development assistance for all causes was steadier in decline through much of the 1990s. Added to all of this, the advent of combination antiretroviral therapy, however exciting it was, and however much activists challenged this notion, it began to create the possibility that the North could respond in its own way and the South could be left behind. Did any of this actually matter? It did. A handful of countries, again, Brazil and Thailand with their own resources, Uganda and Senegal with bilateral support, kept up the fight and kept up the success. But overall, as the money and technical cooperation slipped away, so did action on AIDS. And those were the years when HIV spread most rapidly and most extensively around the world. Fortunately, my friend Peter Piat did an amazing job overcoming those obstacles, defining and building up UNAIDS, revitalizing the response to the epidemic despite these many challenges. And those efforts began to bear fruit around the turn of the millennium. I won't go into details of those actions. What happened around the year 2000? It's more recent history and you know it well. UNAIDS overcoming those obstacles, the launch of the World Bank's intensified support, the recognition of the hyperendemic epidemics in Southern Africa, the debates about AIDS as a security issue, the UN General Assembly special session on AIDS, 3x5, the Global Fund, Gates, PEPFAR. And now, in the last year or two, glimmers of hope, of return on this enormous investment of money and energy, stabilizing prevalence around the world, declining infections among young women in many key hyperendemic settings, delayed sexual debut, and increased condom use by young people with multiple partners. These are grounds for hope. But we all know from the UNAIDS report issued last week and from our own experiences that we're nowhere near declaring victory and retiring comfortably into a post-condom world. The new UNAIDS report cites promising service coverage figures, as does our paper in The Lancet. But even with improving coverage, fewer than half of men who have sex with men and injection drug users are reported to have access to prevention services. And these data are based on only the small minority of countries that actually reported. Only 27 countries reported on MSM coverage, and less than half of the MSM were being reached. And while declining HIV prevalence amongst young women is heartening, you see in the Lancet article that the 8 countries in the world with the highest incidence of new infections are all in Southern Africa. And finally, as you all know, for every 2 people who go on treatment today, 5 new people get infected. As Kevin DeCock said in Toronto, we won't treat our way out of this epidemic. I started my remarks with some reminiscing about how each of my co-authors and I first got involved in HIV prevention work. We come from different countries, from different continents. David and Mike started their career as physicians, and Noy and I started as community activists. Thank goodness Noy still is. But despite our very different backgrounds and our different experiences, we all agree on these three main messages. Politics matter as much as programs. We need sustained government leadership and sustained community empowerment. The activists and politicians don't have to agree all the time. Indeed, we've seen that tensions can be healthy, ensuring accountability and driving creativity. But we need leadership from both levels. And similarly, donor action makes a difference. Funding needs to be significant and predictable. Now is not the time for donors to repeat the mistakes of the mid-1990s. Now is the time for them to focus on the prize. Second, we've learned that combination prevention offers our best hope for success. The history of HIV is a history of failed attempts at single solutions and magic bullets. Whether condom social marketing, treatment of STIs, abstinence-only programs, needle exchange divorced from broader harm reduction efforts, or today's calls for circumcision. HIV prevention isn't so complicated that we need to be paralyzed, but we need choices amongst multiple risk reduction options for different people and at different stages of people's lives. Similarly, there have been many attempts to find a single easy delivery strategy, dependence on community mobilization or a big government program, dependence on private sector expertise. But we're not going to market our way out of the epidemic. Just as we need to achieve a mix of behavioral outcomes and medical services that reduce risk, we need multiple strategies for promoting and delivering these services and behaviors. And finally, an exceptional response to an exceptional epidemic does not mean that HIV prevention work should be done in isolation. An exceptional response means the opposite. We need a strong linking of a renewed HIV prevention movement to broader issues in health system strengthening, development, and, of course, human rights. We know a lot about the immediate cause of risk and methods of risk reduction, but we know less about how to affect the context of risk and vulnerability. And we need to learn because we do know what matters. Reflecting on the history and challenge of HIV prevention, we also remember how much HIV has continued to surprise us. We seem to be making some real progress these days in the quality of our evidence, in the design and coverage of our programs, in the level of investment available, in the results being achieved. Now is not the time to oversimplify. Now is not the time to turn away and focus on different challenges. Now is the time to build on what we've learned, to truly halt and reverse the spread of the epidemic. Thank you.
Let's move straight to our second speaker. Dr. Nancy Padian is Executive Director of the Women's Global Health Imperative, and she's a faculty member at the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. Nancy's going to talk about biomedical interventions. Nancy.
Richard, perhaps a little less colorful. Going straight to what I hope to accomplish in this talk, a little bit about what we know works, briefly what are some things ongoing, and then I'm going to spend the bulk of the talk sort of looking back and how is it that we know what we know and what we don't know. Results from trials, progress, some challenges, how we interpret data, the level of evidence, and finally, a way forward. What works? Now, I'm sure I don't need to tell you this. It's been at this conference and everywhere. No HIV vaccine or topical prophylaxis, you'll see why I use that term as opposed to microbicides, will be available in the foreseeable future. For now, male condoms, male circumcision, and the prophylactic use of antiretrovirals to reduce mother-to-child transmission, or contraception also for mother-to-child transmission to prevent unwanted pregnancies are our strategies. Treatment of sexually transmitted infections is a strong public intervention in its own right, but it's had some mixed results. An interesting phenomenon is that the potential for reducing infectiousness in someone infected with an STI may be more effective than acquisition. I'm going to talk a little bit more about ARVs, microbicides, and circumcision, as they're the big ones. Briefly, what do we know about male circumcision? Reduces female-to-male transmission by about 60%. A challenge, however, is in the reduction of male-to-female transmission to ensure that there's sufficient time for wound healing before resumption of sexual activity. There's little evidence of risk compensation or behavioral disinhibition in randomized controlled trials, but that will be very essential to continue to consider for scale-up. Prophylactic use of ARVs. I think there's been a zillion sessions in this conference about PrEP and PEP. What we mean by a new lexicon for prevention is if you think about the prophylactic use of ARVs, it's a unifying theme for both microbicides, pre-exposure prophylaxis, post-exposure prophylaxis, mother-to-child transmission. There's oral, vaginal PrEP, it's really microbicides. With thinking about this in a unifying theme, as Ward said, maybe we'll have fewer meetings to attend. That said, research should focus on reducing infectiousness as in secondary transmission. We can think about method of delivery, a pill, a ring, a patch, single versus combination package, dosing and timing pre or post. That said, resistance and distribution have to be considered both for trials and, more importantly, for scale-up. What about microbicides? I said I was going to call them topical prophylaxis or vaginal PrEP, but I do think a word about their evolution is important, and that is they've evolved from nonspecific products to now ARV-containing products, which hold more promise. As I said, we call that vaginal PrEP. An important issue is to think about them as a way for secondary transmission to reduce infectiousness. But an important phenomenon, which sort of has to do with the history, is this represents a shift. We had this, our original concept was low-tech, low-cost product, and now it's become more complicated, and the ability of achieving it is a more distant future. There may be challenges with resistance, issues with use during pregnancy. Another important phenomenon is that these products most likely will not be effective on other STIs, and they're not a contraceptive. I'm going to go quickly through this in the interest of time. These are just, is there a pointer? Okay, voila. The mouse. I don't count this against my time. There's the numbers of trials for which we're still waiting for results. Most of them have to do with oral PrEP. We're also looking at topical PrEP, aka microbicides. These results are yet to be out. Partners in suppression looking at acyclovir in reducing infectiousness in the person with HSV. Still waiting for results of two topical antimicrobials. We keep switching our terminology, vaginal PrEP, topical methods. Looking at buffer gel and Pro 2000 and HPTN 035. Also looking at, keep doing that, in Pro 2000, and also looking at Pro 2000 in another topical microbicidal product, and one still waiting for the results of one vaccine. Okay. Jumping to an evaluation of how we know what we know and sort of looking back to understand where we are here. This is the scorecard that was originated by Judy Wasserheit. She has a paper out now with Helen Weiss looking at that, and she and I are working on another paper about this. But, you know, with Richard said, these are looking at randomized controlled trials. But if you look at the biological randomized controlled trials, I'm going to try not to screw up the arrow this time, that if you just tally them up, there's 24 trials that we've accounted for. Four of them have had positive results. Three are circumcision. One is bacterial STIs. Some have had negative results. But the vast majority are flat results. That is, there's no association, either negative or positive. Difficult to interpret. What does that mean? Why so many flat results? In addition to our article, there's also a fantastic Institute of Medicine report on this. One issue is there's just less than expected incidence. In many of these studies where you've gone in, the incidence drops, and it's just difficult to detect an effect. Another issue is there's no surrogate markers for HIV. Insofar as we don't have an interim biological measure, we have no choice, really, to go right to phase three trials with perhaps knowing less about a product than we might like. So more opportunity for either failures or flat results. I'm going to talk more about challenges in assessing multi-component interventions, how we've gone about studying these, and a little bit more about suboptimal adherence. But again, most of this is in our article. A big issue, and I'll just talk about my own study, multi-component interventions. What do I mean by that? In my study, we looked at a diaphragm plus STI treatment and prevention plus behavior change, voluntary counseling and testing. Many components. I have to say, though, our focus was on the diaphragm and less on the behavioral aspect, but nevertheless, that was part of the package. This is the case with almost all biomedical prevention trials. The other issue is we hypothesized it to having only a modest level of effect, about a 33% reduction in infection. What are some challenges? Our ability to detect the effect of diaphragms over and above this really extensive prevention package, it's challenging. The other issue is the nature of the control group. This extensive prevention package minus diaphragms is what we're doing in the control group. That is not standard of care in the communities where we did this. So we're sort of ratcheting up the control group in a way that may not be sustainable after the trial is over. So we've sort of made it, by doing gold standard, by doing the best ethical research, we've made it difficult to detect an effect. And then, of course, the other issue, which has been talked about repeatedly, is separating out the effect from adherence, which might be modifiable from the intervention, from the efficacy of the intervention. Just briefly, adherence, as you know, and efficacy are inextricably bound. You need good adherence to detect an effect. On the other hand, if you have an efficacious product, people are going to use it. What can you do about adherence? One thing is we need to measure it better, but we sort of concluded there's two kind of themes. One is to optimize it, and what are some ways that you can make adherence better, make it easier, have coitally independent methods, daily regimens, directly observe perhaps prevention, and also one time only. Also, if we have more potent methods that are enduring and resilient, that require less, where you're not penalized for lack of adherence, slower releasing, that might be another way to deal with adherence. Moving on to level of evidence, and I'm going to show you more about this in another slide. An important point, I think, is, as we said, male condoms are the method, and male circumcision and MTCT, but the level of evidence by which we've concluded that really difference, and I think some of it has to do with the history of the epidemic in the way that Jeff just said. One issue is, all that aside, when we scale up, this is going to become much more complicated. We're going to have to deal with our whole way of thinking about evidence will differ. But let me focus now on how we think about evidence now. This is a table that actually Ward is largely responsible for that's in the article itself. And the way that we thought about it is thinking about adherence as a decision, because one might say, well, do you adhere to male circumcision or is it uptake? So that's one shot. And this is level of evidence as done by the Prevention Task Force, level of effectiveness. And we also tried to think about whether a method was female-controlled or not, because I think we have to widen our horizon about what we think about female-controlled methods. So what you see is, you know, male circumcision, one decision point, quite effective, not female-controlled. Vaccines, there may be a booster, might have several decisions right now. No effect, possibly harm. It is, however, female-controlled. The daily decision methods, STI suppression, looking at, based on level one evidence, we don't know. Oral antiretrovirals, topical antiretrovirals, no effect, no level of evidence that this might work. Coitally related decisions, male condoms. Now, we are saying that these are effective, but based on level two evidence. That is, it's a cohort. I mean, Richard said something about not being slaves to randomized controlled trials. It's interesting that all of these biomedical methods are being tested with randomized controlled trials and held to that gold standard, but that is not the case for male condoms. And then diaphragms, based on level one evidence, not effective over and above the extensive prevention package. Topical microbicides, not including ARVs, perhaps at this point are ineffective. And both of these are female-controlled, and obviously male condom isn't. So what's the way forward? This is what Jeff said, and I think you're going to hear this from all of us. And not only that, I've already heard it many, many times at this conference. There will be no single magic bullet. We have to look at combination packages. I mean, the irony is that although we all have our separate papers and talks, I mean, I'm thinking that the next time Lancet does an issue will be more mixed up and not siloed in the way that we currently are. So ways to think about it are a biological method plus behavior to maintain adherence, to avoid disinhibition or risk compensation, plus structural interventions. We're going to hear about that, which will be essential As I said, the level of evidence will switch when we go to widespread scale-up. They'll be essential for addressing mechanisms that are necessary for scale-up to optimize the effect. What do you need to change in the context in order to have it be effective? And also combination biological packages where you have more than one biological method. For example, male circumcision plus condoms, cervical barriers plus vaginal antimicrobials, or an antiretroviral gel. So we're all going to end on that punchline, and that is there isn't going to be one way to effect prevention, and we need to think deeply about ways to combine them. Thank you.
Let me now introduce Tom Coates. Tom is Professor of Global AIDS Research within the Division of Infectious Diseases at UCLA, where he also leads the program in global health. Tom is going to speak about behavioral strategies to reduce HIV transmission. Tom.
Thank you. Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here today. Let me especially thank Peter Piot and the professional staff of UNAIDS for focusing on prevention, especially at this conference. Let me also thank Richard Horton and Pamela Das from the Lancet for joining with UNAIDS to put this special issue together and for gently nudging us forward beyond our comfort zones.
Yeah.
I would also like to thank those who supported my work, principally the Ford Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, and the Diana Princess of Wales Memorial Fund, and finally my co-authors, Linda Richter and Carlos Caceres. Now, Helene Gale hosted a meeting the other night of the HIV Prevention Working Group, which has been so instrumental in keeping prevention on the table. And the premise of the meeting was, if I were king, what would I do? What would we do?
Or queen.
Or queen. Well, that's what I and my co-authors, that was our starting premise. What if we were king, queen, or crown prince? Now, the principal difficulty we had is we argued over who got to be what. So we decided on a daily rotation. But we started from this premise. What would responsible leaders do? What can they learn from the past? Do they know enough to... Oh, it's not forwarding. Could somebody please... So what would responsible leaders do? What can they learn from the past? Do they know enough to engage in vigorous action? What do they do now to prevent infections in the absence of clear evidence and to further develop the scientific foundations for HIV prevention? What do they need to do to prepare for the long term? And that's a second subtext and theme of this conference. We're moving into the long term. What we said is progress is possible, and that we think that there's great reason to be very optimistic. But it's not simple. It's not simplistic. There's no magic bullet. Change has happened. It hasn't happened in the randomized controlled trials, but as Mike Cohen said, it has happened in practice. We have an idea of what can make it happen. We know what to do to develop the scientific base, and we know how to document effectiveness. Now, one of the premises, one of our starting points, and one of the major premises from which we started was this. And that is, we come to conferences like this, and we talk about sexual activity as an antiseptic act. And we talk about URAI and UROI, and, you know, we sort of use these acronyms. But in reality, sexuality is much more complicated than that. And people engage in sexual behavior for a lot of different reasons, for procreation. Now, the U.S. government would like us to stop there. But some people actually do it for fun. Some people do it for money. Some people don't have a choice. And then there's substance use. It's a well-known fact that the economies of many countries are dependent on substantial intakes of various substances, whether it be in the normalized economy or in the underground economy. What do we do about that as a major driver of the epidemic? So we need to talk about these realities in a much more complicated way. HIV prevention, lesson number one, requires radical, not subtle, behavioral change. And we have enough case studies now to know what goes into that formula. It's political support, institutional participation, good laboratory surveillance, VCT, information education, behavioral options. Delay intercourse, reduce partner number, use condoms, reduce needles, syringe sharing, access VCT, male circumcision, PMTCT, and treatment. People like choice. We can't reduce it to one or the other. As Peter Piot said the other night, if we do that, we're playing with fire. But it also requires mobilization and community buy-in, inspirational leaders, community-grown strategies, support for persons with HIV, and access to technological advances. We've seen that in Uganda. We've seen that in Tanzania. We've seen that in other countries where HIV prevalence has dropped. We're seeing it in Namibia now. We're beginning to see it in Botswana for HIV prevention. HIV prevention, we've talked about combination as being essential. And we've talked about the elements of combination prevention, behavioral change, biomedical strategies, treatment for people with HIV, and attention to social justice and human rights. The third key point, we know that prevention programs can do better. We know we can do better. Now, one of the acronyms, and it's served its purpose, but Chris Collins and Jim Curran and I say, let's bury it. Let's bury the ABCs. And the problem doesn't get solved by squaring C or cubing C or adding other letters of the alphabet. It's time to scrap the ABCs and elevate the discussion. Small-scale, isolated HIV prevention programs will not bring the AIDS epidemic under control. ABC infantilizes prevention. It oversimplifies what should be an ongoing strategic approach to reducing incidence. Let's not use that terminology anymore. Everybody who agrees to that, put your hand up. Thank you. The fourth key point, prevention science needs to do better. There is a major misalignment between the behavioral science that's done and the behavioral science that needs to be done. And here I'm speaking primarily to the United States and to the National Institutes of Health and to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We have become slaves to the randomized control design, and the result of that is that the design determines the intervention and not the other way around. And what we need to do is to design evaluations and studies that match the need. And the fifth key point is that we need to get the simple things right. We're not even doing the simple things right. So there's been a lot of discussion at this conference about concentrated epidemics, injection drug users, men who have sex with men, those are the ones with the happy faces, and and commercial sex workers. And as was pointed out by Jeff O'Malley in the UNAIDS Indicator Project, first of all, it's difficult to get countries to report on what they're doing with these populations. Remember, there are 187 member countries. And even among those who are reporting, those who are saying they are reaching sex workers, 60%, those who say they are reaching injection drug users, 46%. Those who say they are reaching men who have sex with men, 40%. So this is among those who are reporting. If we made the denominator the entire number of countries, you probably wouldn't be able to see the bars on the graph. So we've got to get the simple things right. We've got to do now what we know can work. This is the other thing. So the 2010 goal was that over 90% of young men and women would get all the answers correct on a simple test of HIV knowledge. And we're at 40%, and we've missed the 2005 goal, and it's not clear that we're going to get to the 2010 goal. So HIV prevention, in summary, is possible. We've seen that. It's not simple. It's not simplistic. But it is hampered by unparalleled impediments. Thank you. It's not being implemented. It cannot be reduced to formulas. And as we've seen time and time again, it requires radical commitment. Now, one of the linchpins of the Ford Global HIV/AIDS Initiative, Global Initiative under Jacob Gale, is leadership. And I think the next best thing that we can do in the HIV epidemic is to support inspirational people, because every good thing we've seen come in HIV prevention comes from somebody with inspiration and charisma. And I think that's the next place we need to go with HIV prevention. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Our next speaker is Dr. Jessica Ogden. Dr. Ogden is the director of Ogden Health and Development Connections, a long-term consultant for the International Center for Research on Women, and was also working directly with ICRW for several years as a senior technical specialist in HIV/AIDS and development. She's going to talk about the article that she co-authored on structural approaches to HIV prevention.
Thanks. Do I need to do anything? Yes. Check the blue box. Oh, fabulous. Sorry about that. Good afternoon. And I just want to briefly thank The Lancet and UNAIDS for creating this opportunity for all of us. And also, of course, to thank my co-authors on whose behalf I'm speaking today. Geeta Rao Gupta, Justin Parkhurst, Peter Agleton, and Ajay Mahal. So I'm not going to review the paper in any detail. I've only got 10 minutes, and you all have the paper. But I just wanted to highlight what I think are the most important contributions to the field that the paper makes, and what I feel are the most important areas for further development. But I'm going to start with a story, like some of my other colleagues here. Back in the mid to late 1990s, I was teaching medical anthropology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine to public health master's students there. And I saw it as a part of my responsibility to inspire them, some of the most bright and promising doctors, nurses, and public health specialists in the world, to shift the response away from solely focusing on individual behavior change programs to HIV prevention, to a more complex approach. And as one of the few anthropologists they were to come across during their studies, I hope to help them see that these individual approaches alone do not and cannot equip people with the tools that they need to change their behaviors that put them at risk for HIV. Over the course of the terms and the years that we were together, we discussed how and why human behavior is not only or even mostly a product of physical drive or rational choice, as Tom pointed out, but it's shaped and constrained by and enabled by a range of factors in the social, political, economic, and physical environment. And these factors determine the extent to which people can, the extent to which people want to adhere to our admonitions to use condoms or stick to one partner or to use clean needles and injection equipment, as well as to the extent to which it makes sense for them to do so in the context of their everyday lives. And I proposed to them that AIDS is not the only thing that people have to worry about in their lives, or even the most important thing that they have to worry about, and that if they learn nothing else from me, that I hope that they would, by the end of the term, understand that changing human behavior requires understanding and acting upon the context in which that behavior takes place. I would put up a slide that said, quite simply, context matters. And then I would look out at a sea of faces, more or less like I'm doing today, and see a lot of blank eyes staring numbly back at me. So if my former students are in the audience, you are, of course, the exception to that rule, among the brightest. So many of you will not even remember those days or not even know about them, when it was not so well understood as it is now or accepted that context matters, and that those key dimensions of the social, political, and economic context that we now refer to as structural factors are so important in shaping HIV and other health outcomes. So the happy fact is that by and large, the field now gets it. It's, of course, down to my great teaching. And as the AIDS community has shifted slowly away from an emergency effort to a long-term response, there's been increasing consensus that structural factors play a critical role in shaping HIV epidemics. It's now fairly well understood and is a recurrent theme, certainly among the series in this Lancet series, that addressing these factors should constitute an important part of a long-term response to AIDS, a response that needs to cast its net wide and deploy a combination of approaches, as we've heard time and again, but not in a top-down deterministic way, but in real partnership with its intended beneficiaries, based on a solid understanding of the contextual factors of concern. And this is what we refer to in the paper as taking a structural approach. So structural approaches aim to change the conditions in which people live and act and enact health behaviors. They can be implemented as single policies or programs, or multiple structural actions implemented simultaneously, or community processes that catalyze social and political change, or all of these in some combination. In the paper, we offer examples of structural approaches to HIV prevention that have been effective in creating positive outcomes in a range of different populations. And I hope that some of you will have taken time out this week to listen to some papers presenting some results from those studies. But at least three critical roadblocks remain in the way of progress. The paper attempts to articulate these challenges and propose some concrete tools for addressing them. And I will highlight them briefly here. Firstly, because the range of factors influencing AIDS-related behaviors is so broad, it can be difficult to determine where responsibility lies for addressing them. After all, structural factors operate at different levels and different distances from risk and vulnerability. Structural factors link to risk and vulnerability in different ways, according to context and the wider interpersonal relationships and so forth. And the relationship between a structural factor and an HIV outcome can be quite complex. Some structural factors are quite far upstream from the behavior of concern or the outcome that they want to achieve. These factors can sometimes be referred to as distal factors, and they include features of the policy and macroeconomic context that, while influencing risk and vulnerability, do so at some distance from that risk and often originate well outside of the health sector. A good example of a structural approach that operates at a distance from the behavior of concern would be a needle and syringe exchange program. And many people don't think of these as being structural approaches because you're providing an individual service to clients. But in fact, they also require important shifts in policy and an attitude of policymakers very often. Sometimes you have to shift an entire program focus from a concentration on prohibition and cure to a focus on harm mitigation and minimization. So we consider such programs to be structural also because they target drivers of risk among drug users, as opposed to providing education messages to use clean needles, which has little to affect the context in which needles are used and the ability of people to get clean needles. So in this example, the relationship between a structural factor, policy facilitating needle exchange, and the behavior, needle sharing, is fairly straightforward. It's the relationship is straightforward if not affecting that change. But this is not always the case. For example, what does it mean, by what means does or can gender inequality, another frequently evoked structural factor influencing the epidemic, influence HIV vulnerability? In order to understand how structural factors such as these affect risk and vulnerability, particularly when structural factor you need to act on operates at some distance from the behavior of concern, it's sometimes necessary to map out the causal pathways between them. Now, let's see if I can do this. I'm not sure exactly how this is going to work. But let's see. So here you have gender inequality on one side. Sorry, they're kind of small. And unprotected sex, the outcome you want to change, on the other. One worked. One causal pathway. In one community, you might have a causal pathway that looks something like this, where you see male physical and economic and social dominance over women, leading to violence against women, which can lead to the inability to negotiate condom use due to the fear of violence. And, of course, that has the outcome of unprotected sex. In another community, your causal pathway might look something like this. You have a dominance of male control over economic resources, leading to women's economic dependence on men, leading to, again, the inability to negotiate condom use for fear of abandonment, or perhaps leading to transactional sex and so forth. And you have HIV outcomes that you don't want to see. So this brings me to the second troubling roadblock we address in the paper. While we are as a community increasingly convinced of the importance of structural factors, we are struggling still to understand how to address them. In the paper, we suggest that while there is no one way to approach this, nor a simple definitive menu of structural approaches, much to the demise of some of my colleagues here, there are a few rules of thumb that can be applied. An essential first step in adopting a structural approach is to take the charge up to know your epidemic and identify your causal pathways. Context analysis of this kind identifies which structures are creating the problem. It can reveal the nature of the causal pathways in your context. It can indicate where, at what level, and who, which sector or set of actors should act and or be engaged in the process of developing change. Some factors may operate distally, while some may be proximate to the behavior of concern. And so understanding all this, mapping this out, is why causal pathway mapping is useful. Now, the tools and methodologies for conducting this sort of analysis do exist. And it can look something like a fairly orthodox public health planning process, or it can be a needs assessment. And also social scientists have a range of tools in which to support people to carry these exercises out. Secondly, it's important to recognize that there's no single blueprint of a structural approach that will work everywhere in the same way. Strategies need to be relevant to the specific population being served and the specific constellations of structural factors involved. We provide some examples in the paper that clearly illustrate this point. A really useful one is to think about microcredit programming. Some of you may know that microcredit programs have been shown to have positive outcomes in some contexts, where they've led to economic empowerment of women and their ability to negotiate condoms and reduce their reliance on transactional sex. They've also been applied in other contexts where they've had negative outcomes, where they've increased the risk of young women who have had to have transactional sex in order to acquire the money to repay their loans. So you can't just take one structural intervention and apply it fully into another without thinking about and taking account of context. But the good news is that although the activities themselves are not necessarily generalizable, it is often possible for the tools and project principles to be applied in a number of different settings, as long as care and time is taken to adapt them to the new setting. And we give some examples of this, including Program H, which has been implemented in a range of different settings. So my time is nearly up. I'm talking too slow. So the third stumbling block, and it's a tricky one, is that there's not a lot of evidence that structural approaches work. And our evaluation methodologies and our standards of evidence are not designed to take account of or to measure the effects of structural approaches. So assessment of their effectiveness has and continues to be a challenge. And we may be able to talk about that a little while later. Although most of the studies seek to apply principles of controlled field trials, attribution in the case of structural approaches can be quite difficult. And there are some important exceptions to that, including the image study. So I'm going to cruise through here. Let's see. In the paper, we highlight several challenges. We actually highlight three challenges in the assessment of structural approaches, and I'm just going to highlight two here since I'm very nearly out of time. Many structural approaches seek to address factors that are quite far upstream from the risk behavior or vulnerability of concern. The further removed a factor is, the more potential causal pathways there can be, the more difficult it is to control for that complexity and understand attribution in any clear-cut way. The second challenge is that many structural approaches, including image and Sonogatchi, is that they often involve social and political mobilization of groups, and they can have all kinds of sort of spin-off activities that you didn't account for at baseline. So what do we do about evaluation? Well, there are a few reasonably good methodologies out there, which we highlight in the paper. There are probably others out there that we don't. But more must be done. We need to be more creative and to be actively thinking about and addressing and developing new methodologies, moving away from the gold standard that everyone is already discussing some of the issues with. We need to invest more and soon in developing these new methodologies. We need to create new partnerships across disciplines, sectors, and communities to help us understand how best to address the impact of these complex responses to AIDS. So we're at a crossroads in the AIDS response at the moment, poised on the brink of an important paradigm shift from an emergency response to a long-term development approach. As we seek to understand how to live over the long haul with AIDS, it's natural and appropriate that the gaze should turn toward making the critical and necessary changes to our social, political, and economic structures to eliminate the conditions of vulnerability and risk, and to finally facilitate a process of creating the conditions in which people can be healthy.
Thanks, Jessica. The next speaker is Dr. Stefano Bertozzi, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Evaluation Research and surveys at the National Institute of Public Health in Cuernavaca, Mexico. He will be speaking today on making HIV prevention programs work.
Thank you, Helene. I'd like to start by thanking Richard and Pam Das to invite me to co-edit this special issue with Peter Piot and Pranima Mane, and then all of them for inviting me to write this paper, because it really has been an exceptionally fun and sometimes frustrating but rewarding experience. And I also want to thank and acknowledge my co-authors, Marie Laga and Sergio Bautista and Alex Cautinho, who are all here at this meeting for follow-up discussions. Now, we've just heard four inspirational, motivating talks. I've been asked to depress all of you. And what I mean by that is that we've heard a number of times at this conference about the successes that we're starting to see in some parts of the world in prevention, but I'd like to focus on the half-empty part of the glass. So you'll forgive me, I acknowledge those successes, but I'm not going to talk about them. What I'm going to talk about is the fact that we've had 25 years of prevention efforts for what really is an easily preventable disease. We've spent billions of dollars doing it, yet we still have, last year, 2.7 million new infections. By any possible criteria, that's not a success, at least not enough of a success. So my question is, what went wrong? And how is it possible that that appears on my screen, but not on your screen? No sé si me entienden. Hay un problema porque aquí me aparece what is wrong. Ya, gracias. Well, I think that there are three very obvious options. Well, it's better than Durban when they had the wrong presentation. So what are these three obvious options? The first is that the available interventions that we have are not sufficiently effective. They don't work well enough. The second is that we're doing a bad job at implementing the ones that we do have. And the third is that we're not doing enough. And the answer is yes. All of them are true. So I'd like to talk a little bit about each of them, but most about the second. The first is the available interventions are not sufficiently effective. We don't have the tools that we would like to have, and you've already heard about that, so I'm going to jump very quickly. We've got to continue the research efforts that Nancy talked about. We've got to expand the research efforts that both Tom and Jessica talked about. But I'd like to skip to the second one, and that is, why aren't we doing a good job at implementing the interventions that we have available? I think the first problem is that we're not implementing the right interventions in the right places. The combinations that we're selecting today are not appropriately matched to the local epidemic and the incidence that we expect in each of those places. I remember when I went around visiting countries as part of the PEPFAR evaluation. They were supposed to prevent 7 million infections with the first, I'm sorry, 2, 7, 10. Yes, 7 million infections in the first 5 years of PEPFAR. When I got to the countries, I would ask, they would have an idea of how many infections they were supposed to prevent in that country. And my question would be, where are those infections going to occur that you are going to prevent? Because if you don't know where you expect them to occur, it's very unlikely that your prevention programs are going to get to the people who would have been infected and, in fact, prevent those infections. So here is a little map of the world in which it shows how extraordinarily different, even at the regional level, the epidemics are by region. Inside of each region, it's equally heterogeneous, and inside each country, it's equally heterogeneous. So we should see extraordinarily different combinations of packages of interventions in different places around the world, and although they are somewhat different, they're not nearly different enough. And where they are different, as this slide will show you, from a number of different countries in Africa, it doesn't seem to make sense relative to the changes that you see or the differences that you see in the type of epidemic. So if we can't see some obvious correlation between the package of intervention being implemented and the characteristics of the epidemic, it strongly suggests to me that we're not picking the right packages for the right epidemics, and that could be greatly improved. Secondly, let me just mention, what is the knowledge gap? Obviously, there's an action gap, but there's also a knowledge gap. Because even though we talk about the fact that we've seen places where prevention is working, we don't know nearly enough about the effectiveness of different interventions in different settings. We have ramped up huge prevention programs thanks to the money that's come online over the last few years, and we have systematically not included prospective evaluation of impact in those scale-ups. So we have done without learning by doing, and that was extremely irresponsible. We have to stop doing that, and as we continue to scale up interventions, now learn by doing. In other words, not expecting that all the learning comes, as Tom mentioned, from randomized trials, but learn from the actual implementation that we are conducting. Next, who and where? Even if we're implementing the right package, we're not ensuring that that package gets to the people who are most likely to become infected. And epidemics are heterogeneous with respect to who becomes infected everywhere. Even in the most hyper-endemic countries in Southern Africa, the probability of infection is not constant by age. If you're 5 years old, or 20 years old, or 60 years old, the likelihood of you becoming infected is not constant, nor is it constant if you're a man or a woman, nor is it constant in different parts of the country. We have to do a much better job of figuring out where you expect the infections and responding to that expectation. We have a knowledge gap. We don't know enough about where we expect infections to occur. Now, that's a combination of the fact that we should be doing better epidemiology with the tools that we have and the better tools that we need to better identify incident infections. And thirdly, and for me the one that we've been most grossly ignoring up until now, and that's the question of the fact that even if we're implementing the right interventions for the right people, we're not delivering them properly. The costs are high, the quality is low, and the coverage is low. And I know that very few of you were in the satellite session that Avahan organized on Sunday morning because, I mean, how could you get here Sunday morning, right? It was extraordinary, that satellite, because Avahan has not invented new prevention interventions, but they have invented new ways of managing the implementation of interventions at very large scale. And at the end of the session, one of the Avahan staff offered me the possibility of helping to facilitate learning by others from what they have been doing. They manage the way the private sector manages. You can't imagine McDonald's not knowing how many hamburgers it sells in each of its franchises. But how many programs do we know where we don't have the foggiest idea how many clients a VCT clinic is seeing? What we have been doing up until now in prevention is typically asking people to submit proposals and fanning out money, rather than deciding with the communities, with the NGOs, what needs to be implemented, and then franchising that out and monitoring and making sure we actually deliver it. The private sector has a huge amount to teach us on how you actually manage the delivery of interventions at scale, and we're not paying attention to that. Here's an example. With colleagues in these five countries, led by the team at the University of California in San Francisco, we looked at the costs per intervention delivered in five different countries, Mexico, Uganda, Russia, India, and South Africa. And you can see here that there's a general downward trend where the cost per, in this case, VCT client served, trends down with the number of clients that that clinic serves in a year. But that's not the message of this slide. The message of this slide is that both of these graphs are log graphs. So what you're looking at here is that the lowest cost clinics are serving clients for less than $10 per client served, and the most expensive ones are costing almost $1,000 per client served. You say to me, that's impossible. I say, no, it isn't. If you fund me to set up a VCT clinic, and I spend all the money to set it up, and I see three clients a month, I can easily spend $1,000 per client. But look, within that pattern, here's India. If you looked at That's the trend line. But if you looked at the most efficient clinics at each scale, you'll see that even the least efficient clinics at each scale don't look to be very far from what the best ones look like. But this is Russia. That's extraordinarily heterogeneous, and Mexico looks almost as bad. So that I think that we would find, if we looked more at this, and I have to ask myself, how is it possible we don't know this information all over the world? Because how could you possibly manage efficiently the delivery of these interventions if you don't know what it's costing you per client? If you don't know, by definition, you can't know, you can't possibly be managing efficiently. Imagine if Volkswagen didn't know what a car cost or McDonald's didn't know what a hamburger cost. So that suggests a data gap. that we need provider-level cost, quality, and coverage information, and that's where Avahan has been extraordinarily innovative, not because they invented it, but because they took lessons from the private sector and applied it to the rollout of these interventions. And finally, there's a capacity gap, which is critical to all of the above, because we're not born knowing how to do any of these things. And the point for me, though, is that just because you don't have the capacity doesn't mean it's too expensive to develop it. By not paying attention to these issues, we spend far more money, because we waste money, than we would if we did them properly, even with the existing interventions we have available. And the last point, number three, is that we're not spending enough on prevention. And the question is, how much should a country spend on prevention? And I'm not going to go into it. I'm just going to leave you with a pretty graph and suggest you read the paper. So to close, I want to leave you with some recommendations. We obviously need to continue to invest in what Nancy called for. We need to develop new technologies, better ones, to measure incidence and software and tools to model epidemic behavior so that we can estimate incidence even in absence of those. We need to innovate and experiment with new behavioral and structural prevention approaches. I'm not suggesting that we reallocate away from the biomedical. I'm suggesting we need new money for this. We need to learn while doing. Stop scaling up massive interventions where we could do it in a way that allows us to measure impact. Invest in education, not just training. That was one of the principal findings of the PEPFAR evaluation. If all we do is think with a one-year horizon, we're going to train existing doctors to how to deliver ART. We're going to train existing teachers to deliver prevention messages. We're not going to train the new people that are needed to scale up our programs. We need to be more efficient about our delivery, and one way we can encourage that is to follow some of the initial innovations that have come from the Global Fund and that we see in action down to the bottom level in Avahan, and that's tying funding to performance. And finally, we need to generate new knowledge, as I've said. We need to collect better data, as I've said. We need to strengthen our capacity to use the data to manage more effectively, as I've said. But none of those, the fact that we don't have them today, are excuses for not doing more and better with the people and tools that we currently have, because we could do a hell of a lot better with what we currently have. Thank you.
Thank you, Steph. And our final speaker is Dr. Piat, who is the executive director for UNAIDS and has been since its creation in 1995. And as many people have said, he has done an incredible job to really put prevention back on the map where it belongs through the efforts of UNAIDS and through the advocacy of UNAIDS. Peter is going to talk about coming to terms with the complexity, a call to action for HIV prevention.
Thank you, Aline, and good afternoon, everybody. Let me also say that I'm really happy that that conversation in my old office with Richard led to something. And thank you, Richard and Pam, for really stimulating us. But I would like to particularly thank Purnima Mane, UNFPA, and Steph Bertozzi for being co-editors of this volume. Okay. And here you can see also the co-authors of the paper. I've been to every single AIDS conference, and it is true that the last several years prevention was definitely not at the forefront. But on the very first conferences, that was all that was there. It was the epidemiology and then virology and discoveries and so on, biology. Because there was also a lot going on, particularly in the gay community in the West and in Australia. And as Jeff O'Malley and Richard have said, we've wasted a lot of time. But perhaps, possibly and paradoxically, it may not have been possible to get serious about prevention before we had bitten the bullet on treatment. And that may be a paradox that doesn't sound very rational, but coming one with a massive prevention efforts in the community where people are dying and where there's not a feeling that we do something, that is simply not a very rational option. And secondly, if there's so much money for prevention today, even if it's not enough, it's because also of treatment. And so that is the kind of paradox that we always need and the contradictions of life, I guess. I'll focus on the last part of our paper, and that's the call to action, because basically all the rest has been said. And it's a call of action, a call to action of all authors of every single paper. So it's not just the authors of the paper you see here. And we basically what we're saying is that we have strong and enough evidence that what works is combination prevention for at least two reasons. The evidence, as we heard, and then also a very important one equally that what Tom mentioned, and that is the need for choice. Thanks. So there are four steps that we identified to effective combination prevention. First, something that has become more at the forefront, and it's knowing your epidemic and act on it. History has shown us that we have been very slow to recognize that HIV dynamics are very high and that we still may come up with surprises. And that's why accurate and timely surveillance is so important, not only classic epidemiologic surveillance, but also surveillance that takes into account populations, behavior, social context. And also that initial HIV outbreaks in highly vulnerable populations have been followed in some cases, but not in others, by slower spread, which affects sometimes much larger numbers of people. And Jeff Garnett yesterday in his plenary addressed this also, and so that we can predict more or less where we're going in the short and medium term, but in the long term, frankly, that is highly uncertain. And we should accept that and not become too dogmatic about that. A scaling of the optimal mix to the levels needed for maximum impact is a key. Setting specific operational targets, both ambitious and actionable, and generating systematic social change. All this was discussed. And I would like to add, as I said in my opening speech, that single or double interventions, the magic bullets, I think are not only not effective, but frankly, they may be even counterproductive and give rise to more, a higher incidence and more infections. There are no shortcut one-dimensional solutions, and we have to really disabuse ourselves of the notion that the epidemic can be conquered by this magic bullet. Rather, we should focus on scaling up combination efforts and on building the evidence base on which mixes produce maximum effect. And I think also, particularly following Steph's paper, we should focus at least as much on the how as on the what. And I think in the current stage, improving the how is probably going to be even more effective and have more results. Combination prevention, what does it mean? It depends where you are. But it means addressing immediate risks, so needles, condoms. You see a small piece of foreskin all there. On the right hand, as well as addressing underlying vulnerability, services and commodities, changing social norms. And pulling out any of these elements would be as damaging to the effectiveness of prevention programs as it would be to pull out one of the drugs in combination treatment, as you see on the left-hand side. Coverage and scale are really key, as we've heard, and I also have a couple of slides on Avahan because I think indeed that it is a prime example of what is possible. But here you see also that it is a mix, in this case of India, to reach highly vulnerable populations of government interventions, which of the government of India, where you, in red or in brown, and in green, Avahan. In some cases, strong civil service, an administration that works and with high coverage by the government. In others, it's a private initiative that did it. One problem that we don't have a solution for yet is what is the tipping point for effective prevention? We know that for treatment, the effectiveness depends on access for every single individual to treatment to save each individual life. But when it comes to prevention, which is both an individual act and a community issue, we don't know. Is there something like a tipping point, as we know, been very well studied for various immunization programs? We don't know. Do you need 80% of coverage, 60%, 40%? So universal access to HIV prevention may not necessarily mean 100%. And knowing that and studying that and in each community or type of community, I think would provide incredibly valuable information on how we should set our targets in a better way. We also have to keep our eyes on the long-term horizon. We just heard from Jennifer a solid case why social change and structural interventions are such an essential element of combination prevention. But for the long term also, the social change is necessary because social norms are going to be the underpinning of a long-term sustainable prevention. Think, for example, about concurrent partnerships and in Southern Africa. That's not something one is going to fix with a few short-term interventions. But some take 2 years before you see the effect. Some take 3 to 5 years. Some, in some cases, we will need far more time. And so that is why it's also so important to, in evaluation of programs, to keep that kind of a timeline in mind. Leadership, as has been said, is very important, something I've been talking about a lot, but I would like to add, besides the political leadership, is also technical leadership. Where is the technical leadership on prevention? It's often in academia, and that, you know, and academic disputes are very important to move the agenda and knowledge. But they can be, frankly, paralyzing when it comes to the real world. And we need to distinguish that. And technical leadership is really an enormous gap in many, many countries when it comes to prevention. The political leadership, we've talked a lot about that. That's why I think that these conferences are so important. But also in terms of accountability, who's in charge of HIV prevention? In a government structure, it's clear that when it comes to treatment, it's the Ministry of Health. When it comes to prevention, which is largely happening outside, it's different. Countries that have a multi-sectoral, et cetera, National AIDS Council, it's clear that that's in charge of it. But so that's an issue that should be clarified. And I would say, in the end, I said, pragmatism and science, what do I mean by that? On the one hand, we know enough to make an impact. So let's be pragmatic, let's do it. On the other hand, you know, we need to make sure that our knowledge improves while we are sailing, as Steph has said. It's time to be frank with young people about sex. That's also part of leadership. And ignoring the realities of sex puts our children in greater danger, not only for HIV, but think of epidemics in many countries of teenage pregnancies, sexually transmitted diseases. This is not just an HIV thing. This goes far beyond that. And people who say we should not invest in sex education, they're really putting our children in high, high danger. And this is an example where good politics can save lives and bad politics kill people. Just take an example, the city of New York, where rates of infection with HIV among 13 to 19-year-old boys have doubled in the past 5 years. And it may even be more now that with the recent figures. And 1 in 4 teenagers across the U.S. have at least one sexually transmitted disease. But many schools, as you see in this article from the New York Times, block access to websites about AIDS, even to access the own curricula from the school system. Or you need parental permission signed to, as if young people don't know how to access all kinds of stuff on the, you know. But that's a real structural obstacle, talking about the structural intervention that could make a difference. We need to work together to build demand. There has not been that push for prevention as for treatment. Prevention activism is really not there. And building that a strong constituency is going to be really key. And I think one of the most significant developments of the last few years has been that TAC, and the T in TAC is for treatment, the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa, has taken prevention, HIV prevention, as a major cause, with marches asking for sex education, for condoms in schools, and so on. And if that would happen everywhere in the world, I'm sure that there will be far more attention going to prevention. We need to broaden also the HIV prevention research agenda, and I don't have the time to go into that. But it's really, for me, a mix of everything that was said, and particularly going to into the how of going to scale the issues that Steph discussed. In academia, I would say the business school here is far more important than the School of Public Health or the School of Medicine to find out what works and how to learn from it. Nearly through. Much talk about this in this conference about strengthening health systems, and that is long overdue, and that is very good. However, with the exception of prevention of mother-to-child transmission, that is not going to have much impact on HIV prevention. Think of sex workers or injecting drug use, harm reduction, and so on. So it's high time, and I hope that the next conference we will also have debates about building capacity for prevention, the issue that Steph brought up. And that is at several levels, and I won't go over it in detail. We are here, the last slide, on Avahan again, where, as far as I know, it's about the only large-scale project that is effectively investing in community capacity. We, in classic public health, we are scared of that. We don't know how to do that because it may challenge some of our, you know, blueprints that we've prepared for these communities. It's not going to work that way. So let me conclude by saying that this series clearly found that combination prevention tailored to each situation does work, but its full potential has not been reached for political effectiveness and programmatic reasons. And yet it would make a huge difference. The papers shown that, for example, if we intensify prevention as of today, 12 million fewer HIV infections will occur between now and 2015 than would have occurred at the current pace of prevention. But progress that we've made is real, but also fragile. We've seen it in countries like Uganda, now Kenya, in Thailand, where we've seen an increase again of new infections. So it's never over. It's also for life. And it's high time, and here I echo Steph, and we hadn't discussed it, but it's high time to bring in true professionals of behavioral and social change into this field. They can help with the how. They can help with the how, and you find them in business. That's the way it is. We've got some examples of social marketing of condoms, and the results are there, but we've not really implied, you know, the Procter & Gamble's and Coca-Cola's and all that, selling sometimes things that are maybe not so healthy, you know, and yet we're doing it. We're buying it. And that, as long as it's combined with the community involvement and the roots, and a good business will do that in any case. They're expensive, but with the current types of investments in HIV prevention, we can afford that. And it would be better to invest in that for some time so that ultimately we will have a better return on the investment and also more effective programs. And I think that will be the next frontier in addition to finding new tools. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Peter. Well, time has beaten us. But what you've heard today, I hope you'll agree, is a compelling, sophisticated, and achievable agenda for prevention implementation at country level. Two final pleas as you're leaving, based on the premise that if we're going to defeat HIV, we have to look beyond the virus. First, if we really believe in what we've heard, believing in prevention, we have to redefine, broaden the definition of prevention. Prevention isn't only about tackling the causes of HIV infection, because HIV casts a long shadow over our societies. Prevention also has to be about treating the consequences of infection for individuals, for families, communities, and our societies. For those left behind when a parent or a partner is no longer with us. And second, prevention will not work if we only define it negatively, stopping something from happening. Prevention also is about allowing human sexuality to flourish as part of our personal quest for liberty and self-realization. It's about fulfilling our hopes for those who are closest to us. It's about living out our belief in a global identity and common future among all of us. Prevention is a positive affirmation of our commitment, not merely to avoid infection, but also to advance a vision of what it means when we call ourselves human. Prevention of HIV/AIDS means sustaining our aspiration to love, to show compassion, to protect dignity, and to feel what is the sheer joy of living on this beautiful, fragile planet. Thank you to our speakers. Thank you to Peter, Panima, and Stefano for leading this project, to our authors, to UNAIDS for their brilliant partnership, to Helene for co-chairing, and for all of you for being here. Thank you very much.
Dr. Piot, when will you and UNAIDS release the rectified guidance note on sex work with appropriate input from the Global Working Group on Sex Work from the Network of Sex Work Projects? We're not going away. You've neglected our input twice, and I'm asking in public now.
So let's go up.